someone somewhere in his intricate cobweb of contacts would give him the bit of information he needed to make the right decision. And if not, talking to the woman in a reassuring manner might smooth things enough to give him the direction he needed. Dalton had only had his new post a short time, but he'd wasted none of it in establishing himself in nearly every aspect of life at the estate. He became a useful colleague to many, a confidant to others, and a shield to a few. Each method, in its own way, earned him loyalty. Along with the gifted people he knew, his ever-growing cobweb of connections virtually hummed like a harp. From the first day, though, Dalton's primary objective had been to make himself indispensable to the minister. During his second week on the job, a researcher had been sent out to the estate libraries by one of the directors from the Office of Cultural Amity. Minister Chanbor had not been pleased. The truth be known, he had flown into a resentful rage, not an uncommon response from Bertrand Chanbor when presented with worrisome, even ominous news. 2 days after the researcher arrived, Dalton was able to inform Minister Chanbor that the man had ended up getting himself arrested, drunk, and in the bed of a harlot back in Fairfield. None of that was a crime of any consequence, of course, even though it would have looked bad enough to some of the directors, but the man was found to have had an extremely rare and valuable book in the pocket of his coat. An extremely rare and valuable book written by none other than Joseph Ander himself. The ancient text, valuable beyond price, had been reported missing from the Minister of Culture's estate right after the researcher went off drinking. At Dalton's instructions, the director's office was immediately informed of the book's disappearance, hours before the culprit was apprehended. With the report, Dalton had sent his personal assurance to the directors that he would not rest until the malefactor was found, and that he intended to launch an immediate public investigation to discover if such a cultural crime was the precursor to a treasonous plot. The stunned silence from the office of the directors had been thunderous. The magistrate in Fairfield, the one for whom Dalton had once worked, was an admirer of the Minister of Culture, serving as he did at the minister's pleasure, and of course did not take lightly the theft from the Anderith Library of Culture. He recognized the theft for what it was, sedition. The researcher who had been caught with the book was swiftly put to death for cultural crimes against the Anderith people. Far from quelling the scandal, this caused the air to become rampant with ugly rumors of a confession taken before the man was put to death, a confession, it was said, that implicated others. The director who had sent the man to the estate to do research, rather than be associated with a cultural crime as a point of honor and in order to end speculation and innuendo, had resigned. Dalton, as the minister's official representative looking into the whole affair, after reluctantly taking the director's resignation, issued a statement discrediting the rumors of a confession and officially closed the entire matter. An old friend of Dalton's had been fortunate enough to earn the appointment to the suddenly vacant seat for which he had been working nearly his whole life. Dalton had been the first to shake his hand, the hand of a new director. A more grateful and joyous man Dalton had never met. Dalton was pleased by that, by seeing deserving people, people he loved and trusted, happy. After the incident, Bertrand Chanbor decided his responsibilities required a closer working relationship with his aide, and designated Dalton as chief of staff as well as aide to the minister, thus giving him authority over the entire household. Dalton now reported only to the minister. The position had also accorded them their latest quarters, the finest on the estate other than those of the minister himself. Dalton thought Teresa had been even more pleased about it than he, if that was possible. She was in love with the apartment that came with the elevated authority. She was captivated by the people of noble standing among whom she now mingled. She was intoxicated with meeting important and powerful people who came to the estate. Those guests, as well as people of the estate, treated Teresa with the deference due one of her high standing, despite the fact that most of them were nobly born and she, like Dalton, was well born but not noble. Dalton had always found matters of birth to be petty and less consequential than some people thought, once they understood how auspicious allegiances could be considerably more significant to a providential life. Across the room, Teresa cleared her throat. When Dalton turned from the desk, she lifted her nose and, with noble grace, stepped out into the sitting room to display herself in her new dress. His eyes widened. Displaying herself was exactly what she was doing. The fabric glimmered dreamlike in the light from lamps, candles, and the low fire. Golden patterns of leafy designs swirled across a dark background. Gold-colored piping trimmed seams and edges, drawing attention to her narrow waist and voluptuous curves. The silk fabric of the skirt, like new wheat, hugging every nuance of the rolling lowland hills, betrayed the shape of her curvaceous legs beneath. But it was the neckline that had him speechless. Sweeping down from the ends of her shoulders, it plunged to an outrageous depth. The sight of her sensuous breasts, so exposed, had a profound effect on him, as rousing as it was unsettling. Teresa twirled around, showing off the dress, the deeply cut back, the way it sparkled in the light. With long strides, Dalton crossed the room to catch her in his arms as she came back around the second time. She giggled to find herself trapped in his embrace. He bent to kiss her, but she pushed his face away.
"Careful. I've spent hours painting my face. Don't muss it, Dalton."
She moaned helplessly against his mouth as he kissed her anyway. She seemed pleased with the effect she was having on him. He was pleased with the effect she was having on him. Teresa pulled back. She reached up and tugged the sequined gold ribbons tied to her hair.
"Sweetheart, does it look any longer yet?" she asked in a pleading voice. "It's pure misery waiting for it to grow."
With his new post and attendant new apartments, he was moving up in the world, becoming a man of power. With that new authority came the privileges of rank. His wife was allowed to wear longer hair to reflect her status. Other wives in the household wore hair nearly to their shoulders. His wife would be no different, except perhaps that her hair would be just a little longer than all but a few other women in the house, or in the whole land of Andorith, for that matter in the whole of the Midlands. She was married to an important man. The thought washed through him with icy excitement, as it did from time to time when it really sank in just how far he had risen and what he had attained. Dalton Campbell intended this to be only the beginning. He intended to go further. He had plans. And he had the ear of a man with a lust for plans, among other things. But no matter, Dalton could handle such petty matters. The minister was simply taking the perks of his position. "Tess, darling, your hair is growing beautifully. If any woman looks down her nose at you for it not yet being longer, you just remember her name, for your hair in the end will be longer than any of theirs. When it finally grows, you can then revisit that name for recompense." Teresa bounced on the balls of her feet. As she threw her arms around his neck, she squealed in giddy delight. Intertwining her fingers behind his back, she peeked up at him with a coquettish look.
"Do you like my dress?"
To make her point, she pressed up against him while gazing into his eyes, watching deliberately as his gaze roamed lower. In answer, he bent to her and, in one swift motion, slipped his hand up under her silky skirt, along the inside of her leg, up to the bare flesh above her stockings. She gasped in mock surprise as his hand reached her private places. Dalton kissed her again as he groped her. He was no longer thinking about taking her to the feast. He wanted to take her to the bed. As he pushed her toward the bedroom, she squirmed out of his lustful grip.
"Dalton, don't muss me, sweetheart. Everyone will see the wrinkles in my dress."
"I don't think anyone will be looking at the wrinkles in the dress. I think they will be looking at what is spilling out of it." "Teresa, I don't want you to wear such a thing anywhere but to greet your husband at the door upon his return home to you." She playfully swatted his shoulder.
"Dalton, stop."
"I mean it." He looked down her cleavage again. "Teresa, this dress is...
it shows too much."
She turned away.
"Oh, Dalton, stop. You're being silly. All the women are wearing such dresses nowadays."
She twirled to him, the flirt back on her face.
"You aren't jealous, are you, having other men admire your wife?"
She was the one thing he had wanted more than power. Unlike everything else in his life, he entertained no invitations for understandings where Teresa was concerned. The spirits knew there were enough men at the estate who were admired, even envied, because they gained for themselves the courtesy of influence, inasmuch as their wives made themselves available to Minister Chanbur. Dalton Campbell was not one of them. He used his talent and wits to get where he was, not his wife's body. That, too, gave him an edge over the others.
His forbearance was rapidly evaporating, leaving his tone less than indulgent. "And how will they know it to be my wife? Their eyes will never make it up to your face."
"Dalton, stop. You're being insufferably stodgy. All the other women will be wearing dresses similar to this. It's the style. You're always so busy with your new job, you don't know anything about prevailing custom."
"I do. Believe it or not, this dress is conservative compared to what others will be wearing. I wouldn't wear a dress as revealing as theirs. I know how you get. But I don't want to look out of place either. No one will think anything of it, except that perhaps the wife of the minister's right-hand man is a tad prissy." No one was going to think her prissy. They were going to think she was proclaiming herself available to invitation.
"Teresa, you can wear another, the red one with the V-neck. You can still see enough of your cleavage. The red one is hardly prissy."
She showed him her back, folding her arms in a pout.
"I suppose you will be happy to have me wear a homely dress and have every other woman there whispering behind my back at how I dress like the wife of a lowly assistant to a magistrate. The red dress was what I wore when you were a nobody. I thought you would be happy to see me in my new dress, to see how your wife can fit in with the fashion of the important women here. But now I'll never fit in around here. I'll be the stuffy wife of the minister's aide. No one will even want to talk to me. I'll never have any friends."
Dalton drew a deep breath, letting it out slowly. He watched her dab a knuckle at her nose. "Tess, is this really what the other women will be wearing at the feast?" She spun around, beaming up at him. It occurred to him that it was not so unlike the way the Haken girl down in the kitchen had beamed at his invitation to meet the Minister of Culture.
"Of course it's like what the other women are wearing, except that I'm not as bold as they, so it shows less. Oh, Dalton, you'll see. You'll be proud of me. I want to be a proper wife of the minister's aide. I want you to be proud. I'm proud of you. Only you, Dalton. A wife is crucial to a man as important as you. I protect your station when you aren't there. You don't know what women can be like. Petty, jealous, ambitious, scheming, treacherous, traitorous. One clever, nasty word to their husband, and soon it's on every tongue. I make sure that if there is a nasty word, it dies quickly, that none dare repeat it."
He nodded. He knew full well that women brought their husbands information and gossip.
"I suppose. You always said we were partners. You know how I protect you. You know how hard I work to make sure you fit in at each new place we go. You know I would never do anything to jeopardize what you've worked so hard to gain for us. You always told me how you would take me to the best places, and I would be accepted as the equal of any woman. You've done as you promised, my husband. I always knew you would. That was why I agreed to marry you. Even though I always loved you, I would never have married you had I not believed in your future. We have only each other, Dalton. Have I ever made a misstep when we went to a new place?"
"No, Tess, you never have.
Do you think I would recklessly do so now, at a place as important as this, when you stand on the brink of true greatness?"
Teresa was the only one in whom he confided his audacious ambitions, his boldest plans. She knew what he intended, and she never derided him for it. She believed him.
"No, Tess, you wouldn't jeopardize all that. I know you wouldn't." He wiped a hand over his face as he sighed.
"Wear the dress, if you think it proper. I will trust your judgment." The matter settled. She shoved him toward the dressing room.
"Come on now, change your clothes, get ready. You will be the most handsome one there, I just know it. If there is any cause for jealousy, it is I who will have it, for all the other wives will be green with envy that I have the prize of the household, and it is you who will get the whispered invitations."
He turned her around and grasped her by the shoulders, waiting until she looked up into his eyes.
"You just stay away from a man named Stein, Bertrand's guest of honor. Keep your new dress out of his face, understand?"
She nodded.
"How will I know him?"
He released her shoulders and straightened.
"It won't be hard. He wears a cape of human scalps."
Teresa gasped.
"No."
She leaned closer.
"The one you told me about, come from beyond the wilds to the south, from the old world, come to discuss our future allegiance?"
"Yes. Stay away from him."
She blinked again at such startling news.
How stimulating. I don't know that anyone here has ever met such an interesting foreigner. He must be very important.
He is an important man, a man with whom we will be discussing business, so I'd like not to have to slice him into little pieces for trying to force you to his bed.
It would waste valuable time waiting for the Emperor to send another representative from the old world.
It was no idle boast, and she knew it. He studied the sword as intently as he studied the law. Dalton could behead a flea on a peach without disturbing the fuzz. Teresa smirked.
He need not look my way, and he'll not sleep alone tonight either. There will be women fighting over the chance to be with so outrageous a man.
Human scalps! She shook her head at so astounding a notion.
The woman who wins his bed will be at the head of every invitation for months to come.
Maybe they would like to invite a Haken girl to tell them how exciting and grand it was, Dalton snapped.
Haken girl, Teresa grunted dismissively at such whimsy.
I think not. Haken girls don't count to those women.
She turned once more to the important part of his news.
So, no decision has yet been made. We still don't know if Andereth will stick with the Midlands, or if he will break and join with Emperor Jigang from the old world.
No, we don't yet know how it will go. The directors are divided. Stein only just arrived to speak his piece.
She stretched up on her toes to give him a peck.
I will stay away from the man. While you help decide the fate of Andereth, I will watch your back, as always, and keep my ears open.
She took a step toward the bedroom, but spun back to him.
The man has come to speak his side of matters.
Sudden realization stole into her dark eyes.
Dalton, the Sovereign is going to be here tonight, isn't he? The Sovereign himself will be at the feast.
Dalton took her chin in his fingertips.
A smart wife is the best ally a man can have.
Smiling, he let her seize him by his little fingers and tug, pulling him into the dressing room.
I've only seen the man from afar. Oh, Dalton, you are a marvel, bringing me to such a place as I would get to break bread with the Sovereign himself.
You just remember what I said and stay away from Stein, unless I'm with you. For that matter, the same goes for Bertrand, though I doubt he'd dare to cross me.
If you're good, I'll introduce you to the Sovereign.
She was struck speechless for only a moment.
When we retire to bed tonight, you will find out just how good I can be. The spirits preserve me, she added in a whisper. I hope I can wait that long. The Sovereign! Oh, Dalton, you are a marvel!
While she sat before a mirror on her dressing table, checking her face to see what damage he had wrought with his kisses, Dalton pulled open the tall wardrobe.
So, Tess, what gossip have you heard?
He peered into the wardrobe, looking through his shirts, looking for the one with the collar he liked best. Since her dress was a golden color, he changed his plans and decided to wear his red coat. Best anyway if he was to put forth an assured appearance. As Teresa leaned toward the mirror, dabbing her cheeks with a small sponge she had dragged across a silver container of rose-colored powder, she rambled on about the gossip of the house. None of it sounded important to Dalton. His thoughts wandered to the real concerns with which he had to deal, to the directors he had yet to convince, and about how to handle Bertrand Chanbur. The minister was a cunning man, a man Dalton understood. The minister shared Dalton's ambition, if in a larger, more public sense. Bertrand Chanbur was a man who wanted everything, everything from a Haken girl who caught his eye, to the seat of Sovereign. If Dalton had any say, and he did, Bertrand Chanbur would get what Bertrand Chanbur wanted. And Dalton would have the power and authority he wanted. He didn't need to be Sovereign. Minister of Culture would do. The Minister of Culture was the true power in the land of Andereth, making most laws and appointing magistrates to see them carried through. The Minister of Culture's influence and authority touched every business, every person in the land. He held sway over commerce, arts, institutions, and beliefs. He oversaw the army and all public projects. He was the embodiment of religion as well. The Sovereign was all ceremony and pomp, jewels and exquisite dress, parties and affairs. No, Dalton would settle for Minister of Culture. With a Sovereign who danced on the cobweb, Dalton thrummed.
I had your good boots polished, Teresa said. She pointed to the other side of the wardrobe. He bent to retrieve them. Dalton, what news is there from Aidenrill? You said Stein is to speak his piece of the old world and the Imperial Order. What about Aidenrill? What has the Midlands to say?
There was one thing that could spoil Dalton's ambitions and plans. It was the events in Aidenrill. The ambassadors returning from Aidenrill reported that the Mother Confessor has not only thrown her lot and that of the Midlands in with Lord Rawl, the new leader of the Dharan Empire, but she was to marry the man. By now she must be wedded to him.
Married? The Mother Confessor herself married?
Teresa returned her attention to the mirror.
That must have been a grand affair. I can imagine such a wedding would put anything in Andorath to shame.
Teresa paused at her mirror.
But a confessor's power takes a man when she marries him. This Lord Rawl will be nothing but a puppet of the Mother Confessor.
Dalton shook his head.
Apparently he is gifted and not subject to being destroyed by her power.
She's a clever one, marrying a gifted Lord Rawl of Dahara. It shows cunning, conviction, and deft strategic planning. Joining the Midlands with Dahara has created an empire to be feared, an empire to be reckoned with. It will be a difficult decision.
The ambassadors had further reported Lord Rawl a man of seeming integrity, a man of great conviction, a man committed to peace and the freedom of those who joined with him. He was also a man who demanded their surrender into the growing Daharan Empire, and demanded it immediately. Men like that tended to be unreasonable. A man like that could be no end of trouble. Dalton brought out a shirt and held it up to show Teresa. She nodded her approval. He stripped to the waist and slipped his arms into the crisp, clean shirt, savoring the fresh aroma.
Stein brings Emperor Jigang's offer of a place for us in his New World Order. We will hear what he has to say.
If Stein was any indication, the Imperial Order understood the nuances of power. Unlike all indications from Aidenrill, they were willing to negotiate a number of points important to Dalton and the minister.
And the directors, what have they to say about our fate?
Dalton grunted his discontent.
The directors committed to the old ways, to the so-called freedom of the people of the Midlands, dwindle in number all the time. The directors insisting we stay with the rest of the Midlands, join with Lord Rawl, are becoming isolated voices. People are tired of hearing their outdated notions and uninspired morals.
Teresa set down her brush. Worry creased her brow.
Will we have war, Dalton? With whom will we side? Will we be thrown into war, then?
Dalton laid a reassuring hand on her shoulder.
The war is going to be a long, bloody struggle. I have no interest in being dragged into it, or having our people dragged into it. I'll do what I must to protect Andorath.
Much hinged on which side held the upper hand. There was no point in joining the losing side.
If need be, we can unleash the Dominie Dirge. No army, not Lord Rawls, not Emperor Jigang's, can stand against such a weapon. But it would be best, before the fact, to join the side offering the best terms and prospects.
She clasped his hand.
But this Lord Rawl is a wizard. You said he was gifted. There is no telling what a wizard might do.
That might be a reason to join with him. But the Imperial Order has vowed to eliminate magic. Perhaps they have ways of countering his ability.
But if Lord Rawl is a wizard, that would be fearsome magic, like the Dominie Dirge. He might unleash his power against us if we fail to surrender to him.
He patted her hand before going back to his dressing.
Don't worry, Tess. I'll not let Andorath fall to ashes. And, as I said, the Order claims they will end magic. If true, then a wizard wouldn't hold any threat over us. We will just have to see what Stein has to say.
He didn't know how the Imperial Order could end magic. Magic, after all, had been around as long as the world. Maybe what the Order really meant was that they intended to eliminate those who were gifted. That would not be a novel idea, and to Dalton's mind had a chance of success. There were those who already advocated putting to the torch all the gifted. Andorath held several of the more radical leaders in chains, Saren Rajak among them. Charismatic, fanatical, and rabid, Saren Rajak was ungovernable and dangerous. If he was even still alive, they'd had him in chains for months. Rajek believed witches, as he called those with magic, to be evil. He had a number of followers he had incited into wild and destructive mobs before they'd arrested him. Men like that were dangerous. Dalton had lobbied against his execution, though. Men like that could also be useful.
"Oh, and you just won't believe it," Teresa was saying. She had started back on the gossip she'd heard.
As he pondered Saren Rajek, he only half listened.
"This woman, the one I mentioned, the one who thinks so much of herself, Claudine Winthrop, well, she told us that the minister forced himself on her."
Dalton was still only half listening. He knew the gossip to be true. Claudine Winthrop was the perturbed lady in the message in the secret compartment of his desk, the one for whom he needed to find a plum. She was also the one who had sent the letter to Director Linscott, the letter that never arrived. Claudine Winthrop hovered around the minister whenever she had the chance, flirting with him, smiling, batting her eyelashes. What did she think was going to happen? She'd gotten what she had to know she was going to get. Now she complains.
And so, she's so angry to be treated in such a coarse manner by the minister that after the dinner she intends to announce to Lady Chanbor and all the guests that the minister forced himself on her in the crudest fashion.
Dalton's ears perked up.
Rape it is, she called it, and rape she intends to report it to the minister's wife.
Teresa turned in her seat to shake a small squirrel hair eye color brush up at him.
And to the directors of cultural amity, if any are there. And Dalton, if the sovereign is there, it could be an ugly row. The sovereign is liable to hold up a hand, commanding silence so she may speak.
Dalton was at full attention now. The 12 directors would be at the feast. Now he knew what Claudine Winthrop was about.
She said this, did she? You heard her say it.
Teresa put one hand on a hip.
Yes. Isn't that something?
She should know what Minister Chanbor is like, how he beds half the women at the estate, and now she plans to make trouble.
Should create quite the sensation, I'd say.
I tell you, Dalton, she's up to something.
And Teresa started prattling onto another subject. He broke in and asked,
what had the other whim to say about her, about Claudine's plans?
Teresa set down the squirrel hair brush.
Well, we all think it's just terrible. I mean, the Minister of Culture is an important man. Why, he could be sovereign one day. The sovereign is not a young man anymore. The minister could be called upon to step into the seat of sovereign at any moment. That's a terrible responsibility.
She looked back to the mirror as she worked with a hairpick. She turned once more and shook it at him.
The minister is terribly overworked and has the right to seek harmless diversion now and again. The women are willing. It's nobody's business. It's their private lives. It has no bearing on public business. And it's not like the little tramp didn't ask for it.
Dalton couldn't dispute that much of it. For the life of him, he couldn't understand how women, whether a noble or a Haken girl, could bat their lashes at the lech and then be surprised when he rose, so to speak, to the bait. Of course, the Haken girl, Beata, hadn't been old enough or experienced enough to truly understand such mature games. Nor, he supposed, had she foreseen Stein in the bargain. Dalton felt a bit sorry for the girl, even if she was Haken. No, she hadn't seen Stein lurking in the tall wheat when she smiled in awe at the minister. But the other women, the women of the household and mature women, come from the city, out to the estate for feasts and parties. They knew what the minister was about and had no grounds to call foul after the fact. Dalton knew some only became unhappy when they didn't get some unspecified but significant recompense, some plum. That was when it became Dalton's problem. He found them a plum, and did his best to convince them they would love to have it. Most wisely accepted such generosity. It was all many had wanted in the first place. He didn't doubt that the women of the estate were agitated that Claudine was scheming to bring trouble. Many of those wives had been with the minister, seduced by the heady air of power around the man. Dalton had reason to suspect many who had not been to the minister's bed wanted to end there. Bertrand either simply hadn't gotten to them yet, or didn't wish to. Most likely the former. He tended to appoint men to the estate only after he'd met their wives, too. Dalton had already had to turn down a perfectly good man as regent because Bertrand thought his wife too plain. Not only was there no end to the women swooning to fall under the man, but he was a glutton about it. Even so, he had certain standards. Like many men, as they got older, he savored youth. He was able to indulge his wont for voluptuous young women without needing, as most men passing 50, to go to prostitutes in the city. In fact, Bertrand Chanbour avoided such women like the plague, fearing their virulent diseases. Other men his age, who could have young women no other way and could not resist, did not get a chance to grow much older, nor did the young women. Disease swiftly claimed many. Bertrand Chanbour, though, had his pick of a steady supply of healthy young women of limited experience and standards. They flew of their own accord into that candle flame of high rank and nearly limitless authority. Dalton ran the side of his finger gently along Teresa's cheek. He was fortunate to have a woman who shared his ambition, but, unlike many others, was discerning in how to go about it. "I love you, Tess." Surprised by his sudden tender gesture, she took his hand in both of hers and planted kisses all along it. He didn't know what he could possibly have done in his life to deserve her. There had been nothing about him that would augur well for his ever having a woman as good as Teresa. She was the one thing in his life he had not earned by a sheer force of will, by cutting down any opposition, eliminating any threat to his goal. With her, he had simply been helplessly in love. Why the good spirits chose to ignore the rest of his life and reward him with this plum, he couldn't begin to guess. But he would take it and hold on for dear life. Business intruded on his lustful wanderings as he stared into her adoring eyes. Claudine would require attention. She needed to be silenced, and before she could cause trouble. Dalton ticked off favors he might have to offer her in return for seeing the sense in silence. No one, not even Lady Chanbour, gave much thought to the minister's dalliances. But an accusation of rape by a woman of standing would be troublesome. There were directors who adhered to ideals of rectitude. The directors of the Office of Cultural Amity held sway over who would be sovereign. Some wanted the next sovereign to be a man of moral character. They could deny an initiate the seat. After Bertrand Chanbour was named sovereign, it would not matter what they thought, but it certainly mattered before. Claudine would have to be silenced. "Dalton, where are you going?" He turned back from the door. "I just have to write a message and then send it on its way. I won't be long." Chapter 18. Nora stirred with a groan, thinking it must be light already. Her thoughts fumbled woodenly in the numb blur between asleep and awake. She wanted nothing so much as to sleep on. The straw beneath her was bunched just right. It always bunched just right in perfect, comfortable, cuddling lumps, right as it was time to be up and out of bed. She expected her husband to slap her rump any moment. Julian always woke just before first light. The chores had to be done. Maybe if she lay still, he would leave her be for just a few moments longer, let her sleep for a few dreamy minutes more. She hated him at that moment, for always waking just before first light and slapping her rump and telling her to get up and to the day's work. The man had to whistle first thing, too, when her head was still a daze in the morning, rickety with sleep still trying to get out of her head. She flopped over on her back, lifting her eyebrows in an effort to wake by forcing her eyes open. Julian wasn't there beside her. A feeling skittered up her insides, bringing her wide awake in an ice-cold instant. She sat up in the bed. For some reason, something about him not being there gave her a feeling of queasy dismay. Was it morning, just about to be light? Was it still somewhere in the night? Her mind snatched wildly to get her bearings. She leaned over, seeing the glow from the embers she'd banked in the hearth before she went to bed. A few on the top still glowed, hardly diminished at all from the way she'd left them. In that weak light, she saw Bruce peering at her from his pallet. "Mama, what's wrong?" his older sister Bethany asked. "What are you two doing awake?"
"Mama, we've just gone to bed," Bruce whined.
She realized it was true. She was so tired, so dead tired from pulling rocks from the spring field all day, that she'd been asleep before she closed her eyes. They'd come home when it got too dark to work anymore, ate down their porridge, and got right to bed. She could still taste the squirrel meat from the porridge, and she was still burping new radishes. Bruce was right. They'd only just gone to bed. Trepidation trembled through her.
Where's your pa?
Bethany lifted a hand to point.
Went to the privy, I guess. Mama, what's wrong? Mama,
Bruce puled.
Hush now. It'd be nothing. Lay back down, the both of you.
Both children stared at her wide-eyed. She couldn't stick a pin in the alarm she felt. Children saw it in her face. She knew they did, but she couldn't hide it no matter how she tried. She didn't know what was wrong, what the trouble was, but she felt it sure, crawling on her skin. Evil. Evil was in the air, like smoke from a woods fire, wrinkling her nose, sucking her breath. Evil. Somewhere out in the night, evil lurking about. She glanced again to the empty bed beside her. Gone to the privy. Julian was in the privy house, had to be. Nora recalled him going to the privy house just after they ate, before they went to their bed. That didn't mean he couldn't go again, but he never did say he was having no problem. Consternation clawed at her insides like the fear of the keeper himself.
Dear Creator, preserve us,
she whispered in prayer.
Preserve us, this house of humble people. Send evil away. Please, dear spirits, watch over us and keep us safe.
She opened her eyes from the prayer. The children were still staring at her. Bethany must feel it, too. She never let nothing go without asking why. Nora called her the why child in jest. Bruce just trembled. Nora threw the wool blanket aside. It scared the chickens in the corner, making them flap with a start and let out a surprised squawk.
You children go back to sleep.
They lay back down, but they watched as she squirmed a shift down over her nightdress. Shaking without knowing why, she knelt on the bricks before the hearth and stacked birch logs on the embers. It wasn't that cold. She thought to let the embers do for the night, but she felt the sudden need for the comfort of a fire, the assurance of its light. From beside the hearth, she retrieved their only oil lamp. With a curl of flaming birch bark, she quickly lit the lamp wick and then replaced the chimney. Children were still watching. Nora bent and kissed little Bruce on the cheek. She smoothed back Bethany's hair and kissed her daughter's forehead. It tasted like the dirt she'd been in all day, trying to help carry rocks from the field before they plowed and planted it. She could only carry little ones, but it was a help.
Back to sleep, my babies, she said in a soothing voice. Pa just went to the privy. I'm only taking him a light to see his way back. You know how your pa stumbles his toes in the night and then curses us for it. Back to sleep, the both of you. Everything is all right. Just taking your pa a lamp.
Nora stuck her bare feet into her cold, wet, muddy boots, which had been set by the door. She didn't want to stub her toes and then have to work with a lame foot. She fussed with a shawl, settling it around her shoulders, fixing it good and right before she tied it. She feared to open the door. She was in near tears with not wanting to open that door to the night. Evil was out there. She knew it. She felt it.
Burn you, Julian,
she muttered under her breath.
Burn you crisp for making me go outside tonight.
She wondered if she found Julian sitting in the privy, if he'd curse her foolish woman ways. He cursed her ways sometimes, said she worried over nothing for no good end. Said nothing ever came of her worrying, so why'd she do it? She didn't do it to get herself cursed at by him. That sure was the truth of it. As she lifted the latch, she told herself how she wanted very much for him to be out in the privy and to curse her tonight, and then to put his arm around her shoulders and tell her to hush her tears and come back to bed with him. She shushed the chickens when they complained at her as she opened the door. There was no moon. The overcast sky was as black as the keeper's shadow. Nora shuffled quickly along the packed dirt path to the privy house. With a shaking hand, she rapped on the door.
Julian? Julian, you in there? Please, Julian, if you're in there, say so. Julian, I'm begging you, don't trick with me, not tonight.
Silence throbbed in her ears. There were no bugs making noise, no crickets, no frogs, no birds. It was just plain dead quiet. Like the ground and the lamp's little glow around her was all there was to the world, and beyond that there was nothing. Like if she left the lamp and stepped out there into the darkness, she might fall through that black beyond till she was an old lady, and then still fall some more. She knew that was foolish, but right then the idea seemed very real and scared her something fierce. The privy door squeaked when she pulled it open. She hadn't even been hoping as she done it, because she knew Julian wasn't in there. Before she got out of the bed, she knew he wasn't in the privy house. She didn't know how she knew it, but she did. And she was right. She was sometimes right about such feelings. Julian said she was daft to think she had some mind power to know things, like the old woman what lived back in the hills and came down when she knew something and thought she ought to tell folks of it. But sometimes Nora did know things. She'd known Julian wasn't in the privy. Worse, she knew where he was. She didn't know how she knew, no more than she knew how she knew he wasn't in the privy, but she knew, and the knowing had her shaking something fierce. She only looked in the privy because she hoped she was wrong, and because she didn't want to look where she knew he was. But now she had to go look. Nora held the lamp out, trying to see down the path. She couldn't see far. She turned as she tramped along, looking back at the house. She could make out the window because the fire was going good. The birch logs had caught, and the fire was throwing off good light. The feeling of terrible wickedness felt like it was grinning at her from the black night between her and the house. Clutching her shawl tight, Nora held the lamp out to the path again. She didn't like leaving the children, not when she had her feelings. Something, though, was pulling her onward down the path. "Please, dear spirits, let me be a foolish woman with foolish woman ways. Please, dear spirits, let Julian be safe. We all needs him. Dear spirits, we needs him." She was sobbing as she made her way down the hill, sobbing because she feared so much to find out. Her hand holding the lamp shook, making the flame jitter. At last she heard the sound of the creek, and was glad for it because then the night wasn't so dead quiet and frightfully empty. With the sound of the water she felt better, because there was something out there, something familiar. She began to feel foolish for thinking there was no world beyond the lamplight, like she was on the brink of the underworld. She was just as likely wrong about the rest of it, too. Julian would roll his eyes in that way of his when she told him she was afraid because she thought the world was empty beyond the light. She tried to whistle, like her Julian whistled, so as to make herself feel better, but her lips were as dry as stale toast. She wished she could whistle, so Julian could hear her, but no good whistling sound would come out. She could just call out to him, but she feared to do it. Feared to get no answer. She'd rather just come on him and find him there and then get cursed for her foolish crying over nothing. A gentle breeze lapped the water against the edge of the lake, so she could hear it before she could see it. She hoped to see Julian sitting there on his stump, tending a line, waiting to catch them a carp. She hoped to see him look up and curse her for scaring his fish. The stump was empty. The line was slack. Nora, her whole arm trembling, held up the lamp, to see what she came to see. Tears stung at her eyes, so she had to blink to see better. She had to sniffle to get her breath. She held the lamp higher as she walked out into the water till it poured over the tops of her boots. She took another step till the water soaked the bottom of her nightdress and shift, and dragged the dead weight back and forth with the movement of her steps in the waves. When the water was up to her knees, she saw him. He was floating there, face down in the water, his arms limp out to his sides, his legs parted slightly. The little breeze-borne waves slopped over the back of his head, making his hair move as if it were some of the lake weed. He bobbed gently there in the water, like a dead fish floating on the surface. Nora had feared to find him there like that. It was just what she feared, and because she feared it so, she wasn't even shocked when she saw it. She stood there, water to her knees, Julian floating like a dead bloated carp 20 feet out in the lake. The water was too deep to wade out to get him. Out where he was, it would be over her head. She didn't know what to do. Julian always did the stuff she couldn't do. How was she going to get her husband into shore? How was she going to live? How was she going to feed herself and her children without Julian? Julian did the hard stuff. He knew the things she didn't know. He provided for them. She felt numb, dead, stunned, like she did when she'd just come awake. It didn't seem possible. Julian couldn't be dead. He was Julian. He couldn't die. Not Julian. A sound made her spin around, a thump to the air, a howl like wind on a blizzard night, a wail and a whoosh lifted into the night air. From their house up on the hill, Nora could see sparks shooting up out the chimney. Sparks flew up in wild swirls, spiraling high up into the darkness. Thunderstruck, Nora stood in frozen terror. A scream ripped the quiet night. The awful sound rose, like the sparks,
screeching into the night air with horror such as she had never heard. It was such a brutal cry she didn't think it could be human, but she knew it was. She knew it was Bruce's scream. With a wail of wild terror of her own, she suddenly dropped the lamp in the water and ran for the house. Her screams answered his, feeding on his, shattering the silence with his. Her babies were in the house. Evil was in the house, and she had left them to it. She wailed in feral fright at what she had done, leaving her babies alone. She screamed to the good spirits to help her. She squalled for her children. She choked on her sobbing panic as she stumbled through the brush in the dark. Huckleberry bushes snagged and tore her clothes. Branches slashed her arms as she ran with wild abandon. A hole in the ground caught and twisted her foot, but she stayed up and kept running toward her house, toward her babies. Bruce's piercing scream went on without end, lifting the hair at the back of her neck. She didn't hear Bethany, just Bruce, little Bruce, screaming his lungs out, like he was having his eyes stabbed out. Nora stumbled. Her face slammed the ground. She scrambled to her feet. Blood gushed from her nose. Stunning pain staggered her. She gagged on blood and dirt as she gasped for breath, crying, screaming, praying, panting, choking, all at the same time. With desperate effort, Nora raced to the house, to the screams. She crashed through the door. Chickens flew out around her. Bruce had his back plastered to the wall beside the door. He was in the grip of savage terror, out of his mind, shrieking like the keeper had him by the toes.